Hi there. My name is Rebecca Scout Sanders, and I was the run-of-the-mill skeptic, pessimist, and depressive personality I killed at parties until I studied positive psychology. Now I host Positively Ridiculous Podcast, where we discuss the positive impacts of everyday people, places, and practices that bring happiness, inspire hope, and build flourishing communities in the most unassuming ways. We look at these subjects through the lens of positive psychology and how its science and application can and is improving our lives while riding shotgun with a self-admitted skeptic. So buckle up, Buttercup, and come take a ride on the positive side. During the very first episode of Positively Ridiculous Podcast, I take you on an epic journey of discovery, starting in the ancient times of 1994, when the science of positive psychology was born. We follow it into its teenage years through young adulthood, where we pop in to see how it's doing and see if it's done anything with its life. So strap in and hold on, because it's going to be positively ridiculous. Hello, and happy Tuesday. Welcome to the very first episode of Positively Ridiculous Podcast, or PRP. I'm your host, Scout Sanders, accompanied by my 20-pound mini Bernedoodle, Dagny Joy. We are enormously excited and thankful for your time, attention, and whatever reservations you have today about this podcast, your work day, or your choice of underpants. You have officially entered the community of I see you, I hear you, and I got you. That may sound stalkerish to some, and that's fair. So let me reassure you, I enjoy slightly more constructive and legal hobbies, like podcasting, gardening, golfing, traveling, teaching my dog cool tricks, writing, and lastly, extreme ironing. It's a thing. Look it up on positivelyridiculouspodcast.com. Let us begin by discussing this little campaign of mine to bring you and yours inspiration, hope, community, kindness, and purpose through sharing the stories of the people, places, and practices that create these excellent virtues within individuals, communities, and society at large. I'm interested in the work of unsung heroes who are grinding away on their little streets, neighborhoods, and industries to make way and make room for positive emotions like love, gratitude, and awe. People who are meaningfully engaging with people and communities, building relationships of respect and equality. People who show up every day with meaning and purpose, and who are challenging the status quo with their bravery and achievements. This sounds like a large order, but you know people like this, or are yourself one. You may interact with an everyday hero regularly at school, work, spin class, or the grocery store, but we've become so distracted from our surroundings and lives that we no longer notice kindness or goodness. We overlook the security guard at the front desk who makes a point to say hello and make eye contact with each person that comes through the door, thereby making them feel seen and safe. You can say, okay, but that's just that guy doing their job. But come on, not everybody does that. So what about the retired teacher who continues to tutor kids after school because they don't have parental support for school assignments or someone to turn to for college and career advice? Then there is the kid you witnessed stand up to a bully on someone else's behalf at school the other day. And what about the guy at work who spoke up when he heard male coworkers commenting on a female coworker's weight gain after finding her deeply upset? She confided in that coworker that she was on fertility treatments and things weren't going well. He then shared his and his wife's struggles with conceiving, which made her feel safe and less vulnerable in the workplace. That all counts. All of that is really happening, but we are too distracted, too busy, or just so callous to the good being done in the world that we've just given up on the idea that good changes anything or that it changes us. So the idea becomes positively ridiculous. I'm here to campaign for the ridiculous, and I have a slew of Researchers, experts, executive coaches, philosophers, best-selling authors, Olympians, former pro athletes, journalists, lifestyle gurus, teachers, healthcare providers, CEOs, and founders of Fortune 500 companies who want to come along for the ride and celebrate the good that is being done in the world with positive psychology as its lens. So I know that that was a lot. So before we get underway, let's set our intention for this time together by starting with a deep breath in. So go ahead. Deep breath in. And deep breath out. Again, with a deep breath in. And a deep breath out. The intention that I am setting for today's podcast is to connect with you on a personal level, entertain, educate, and appreciate you. So let's get started. A little about me and how I ended up being a practitioner of positive psychology when I literally had an opportunity to be anything else in the world. I don't intend to overwhelm you with my awesomeness today, but I think providing you with a general overview of who I am and my background is an excellent place to start. So imagine you just swiped right on me, and this is the awkward, hey, and hi, I really like your smile, part of the conversation. I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, home to the Woodrow Wilson Flying Eagles, former NBA pro Tamar Slay, Beckley Exhibition Coal Mine, Tamarack Marketplace, and ridiculously gorgeous Grandview State Park and Golf Club. There's Theater West Virginia, and my personal favorite, Mountain State Miniature Golf. The nephews and I visited there over the summer and had a blast. There is an indoor climbing wall, an ice cream counter, and a coffee shop. Just a really cool and fun place to go with your family, or on an awkward first date, which we witnessed during our visit. Just want to say, may God bless you with endurance and discernment if you are one of the many still looking for true love. As for me, I got a dog. Her name is Dagny Joy, and she works hard for her kibble. Also located in Beckley, West Virginia is West Virginia Tech with its top engineering program and competitive athletic teams. The state is composed of heavenly surroundings and has a plethora of recreational activities and wonderful people. Curious, intelligent, entrepreneurial, hardworking, fun-loving, God-fearing, friendly people. Would you like to know how you can spot a true meathead? Mention you're from West Virginia and wait to see who asks if you want to hear a West Virginia joke. They'll then proceed, even though you've said no thank you, they'll proceed without shame to describe your family and the people that you love as backward, uneducated, dirty, toothless, inbred sheep lovers who only know how to mine coal and go four-wheeling. But they always forget to mention that we all know how to skin a deer and fix your car. It's so offensive. And my answer is always no, by the way. Keep my state and my people out of your mouth. After graduating from high school, I attended the University of North Carolina, where I graduated with honors and a bachelor's degree in nursing. But not before I spent some time in China, working with Hope School of Nursing in Wuhan. Yes, that Wuhan. I then worked as a cardiothoracic intensive care nurse at a major teaching university, and this is where I cut my teeth and learned what it really meant to be a nurse. Expert knowledge in pharmacology and pathophysiology, leadership, outstanding work ethic, high-level problem-solving skills, diplomacy, heaps of patience and empathy to rival any none. Here is where I also learned to ignore my physical symptoms of exhaustion, hunger, my need for quiet and rest, and the need to feel appreciated, seen, and valued. Because after all, I was saving lives, and that should be reward enough, right? Right? I later transitioned to critical care transport and flight nursing after I decided to attend Duke University for my first master's degree. I decided to become a nurse practitioner. I felt like I had grown out of my bedside nursing role, and so I desired more knowledge, independence, income, and opportunity to impact healthcare positively, which was a lofty and idealistic goal, I know. So I continued to work full-time while in graduate school, full-time as well. I worked every weekend for 3 years while I attended classes and clinical during the week. So I have never given birth to another human or had the honor of raising a child, but I still think I can relate to sleepless nights, living a zombie-like existence and mood swings, sore breasts, crying and wondering, is this what I really wanted? Can I take it back? I just want to take it back. I had my first job at 15 and worked through high school and undergrad to support myself, so don't call me a princess just yet. I've always prided myself on being a strong, intelligent, capable woman, but at that point, I didn't care about any of that. I just wanted to be an asleep woman. But I digress. Fast forward to 2018, because after graduating, I had been asleep for that long. And I had been traveling the world for several years, visiting art museums to view rare collections by Salvador Mundi, Pablo Picasso, Gerhard Richter, and Gustav Klimt, just to name a few. I also developed a love for Formula One racing and made special stops in Monte Carlo, Barcelona, and Shanghai to catch a few races. Finally, when I returned to the States, I moved from Boston, where I had been keeping my stuff for 3 years, to a small town in South Carolina, where I was playing golf on the weekends, trained for my first triathlon, and practiced as a vascular surgery nurse practitioner. I was closer in proximity to my family than I had been in years, and warmer. Much, much warmer. But despite the jet-set, comfortable life I was living, my depression and anxiety were, at the time, very poorly controlled. I often self-medicated with an over-the-top pool party or a night of binge drinking with friends, only to find my symptoms off the charts in the following days. When I could barely manage, I would cycle for 20 miles or run during the hottest part of the day to feel like I was in control of my body and mind again. This cycle was repeated for months, and each time becoming less effective. At age 11, it would be fair to say that I began suffering from anxiety and depression. It's been a real ordeal for most of my life, partly due to genetics, but primarily because of many unfortunate circumstances. We may get to those in later shows, but for now, we'll just leave it right there. Then in March, the world received news of COVID-19. Our country and healthcare system went into total crisis. I soon lost my job at the small local hospital because we could no longer take elective cases to the operating room. An elective case is not considered life-threatening. By not taking these patients to the operating room, we preserved personal protective equipment for nurses and other essential staff, ventilators for patients in respiratory failure, and medical staff for the ever-increasing hordes of the afflicted. Surgical specialists like myself were not allowed in the hospital for emergencies, but only for emergencies. The only time I was allowed to step foot into the hospital was when a human being had a life-threatening emergency that needed to be surgically intervened upon, or they would most definitely die. Not maybe die, but actually die. So talk about added pressure and also a lot of downtime. Emergency procedures comprise only a tiny part of what surgeons and surgically trained NPs and PAs do. Now, this does depend on the practice location and trauma center affiliation, but for the most part, our practice consists of office visits, ordering and interpreting tests, seeing consults, making referrals, elective surgeries, and seeing patients in the hospital. But without patients going to surgery, no one can visit before or after a procedure. Annual checkups were pushed back if patients remained asymptomatic or without severe symptoms. So for the first time in 15 years, I had time to sit with myself, sit with my dog, my educational choices, life decisions, hopes, exhaustion, failed relationships, loneliness, regrets. You get the picture. Way before COVID interrupted our lives, I had symptoms of burnout in conjunction with my depression. Suffering from burnout only amplified my signs and symptoms of exhaustion, cynicism, and lack of empathy. Christina Mashlick put it best when she said, "Burnout is an erosion of the soul caused by a deterioration of one's values, dignity, spirit, and will." So imagine every single memory of uncomfortable family holidays hitting you all at once, day after day, for months. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2021, nearly 1.7 million healthcare workers quit their jobs, and 47% plan to leave their current roles by 2025. While the remaining 76% of U.S. healthcare workers say they're exhausted and burned out. This is a crisis of well-being, and it comes at a cost for medical professionals, patients, and healthcare organizations. Concerned for my mental, physical, and financial health, I took to the internet to research burnout, its treatment, and future prevention. I had decided that I could not return to healthcare until I had the treatment and answers I needed for my sake and the sake of my patients. That is when I found a course offered through Coursera titled The Science of Wellbeing. It was being taught to first-year students at Yale. I had everything to gain at that point, so click. State governments soon contracted me to oversee the care of intensive care COVID patients in New York and later in Georgia. I will not detail for you my feelings of helplessness, horror, and righteous indignation as I watched men and women suffer from air hunger, life-ending blood clots, cardiac dysrhythmias, or when a colleague and I placed the orders to withdraw care on an entire multi-generational family who had contracted COVID-19 because they chose not to quarantine due to misinformation. Then the loss of two colleagues after acquiring the virus due to compromised immune systems secondary to stress and exhaustion, and dare I say, lack of adequate PPE. No more. That's all you get from me. I continued studying the concepts described in The Science of Well-Being. This is where I was introduced to positive psychology and the founding father, Dr. Martin E.P. Seligman, and researchers Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, Barbara Fredrickson, Sonia Lubomirsky, Barry Swartz, Isaac and Aura Prelutinsky, and Jonathan Haidt, to name a few. Positive psychology studies positive emotions, positive traits, and positive behaviors. During and after COVID, I needed all the positive anything I could get, so I ate this stuff up with a pinch of salt. Now remember, I'm the first to admit that to a skeptical, critical thinking mind that has seen some stuff, this sounds like fluff, happyology, or self-help dressed up as science. Don't forget that you're riding shotgun with a self-proclaimed skeptic who found the science, its results, and potential so compelling that I earned a second master's degree in applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania to disseminate the stuff and to live it full time. So slow it down, Charlie Brown, and listen up. Positive psychology is a scientific field that studies positive emotions, positive traits, and positive behaviors, leading to increased well-being and flourishing. Formally founded in 1998 by psychologists Martin E.P. Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the origins of positive psychology can be traced back to the 1950s and 60s, when humanistic psychology emerged as a reaction to the mechanistic and reductionistic tendencies of behaviorism and psychoanalysis. The term positive psychology was first coined in 1954 by Dr. Abraham Maslow. He used this term to draw attention to the dichotomous nature of traditional psychology that only focused on the negative aspects of human existence and not the positive human potentialities that made life worth living. Humanistic psychology emphasized the importance of subjective experience, personal growth, and meaningful relationships, which Seligman would later capitalize on in developing this new psychology. During the 1960s, Dr. Seligman, or Marty, as he likes to be called, practiced as a clinical psychologist, seeing people suffering from anxiety and depression in droves. He theorized that depression occurred in people who felt helpless due to uncontrolled aversive events. The 1960s was a tumultuous time, if you remember. The Vietnam War was still raging. There were civil rights protests, the assassination of JFK, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and that was all on top of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The only highlight in the 1960s was the moon landing, meaning to find some peace in the world, you literally had to leave Earth's atmosphere. Marty and fellow researcher Steve Mayer coined the term learned helplessness after studying how animals responded to prolonged stressors. The animals eventually became passive and apathetic. These findings extended to the human population. When we establish an actual or perceived inability to control life outcomes or escape misery, we become depressed. We stop trying to improve our circumstances. Seligman's research and theory were the dominant views of depression for almost 50 years until Marty told the world he was wrong. In the 1960s, Marty and Mayer didn't have access to the same technologies and laboratory developments that we have today. These technologies allowed them to study brain structure and function, resulting in an astonishing discovery. Passivity to prolonged trauma is not learned. It's hardwired into us. The brain is wired for survival. And one primary reason why our species has survived for centuries is thanks to a little-known brain feature known as negativity bias. What are you more likely to pay attention to? A man helping an elderly lady across the street in heavy traffic, or someone running out of the store wearing a mask? If you said neither, because you were likely looking at your phone, I'm glad you decided to join us today. Time and circumstances have taught our species to pay attention to what may harm us, not to what may save us. Our default setting is to become passive because evolution, or design, has provided an off switch that conserves energy in unending lousy situations. The commonly known psychological response of fight, flight, or freeze continually plays out in our body and brain chemistry during these prolonged periods of stress, wreaking havoc on our heart health, digestive and circulatory systems, and hormone levels. The body stays in a constant state of readiness thanks to sustained stress hormones, resulting in agitation, anxiety, muscle aches, fatigue, poor concentration, relationship troubles, and poor financial decisions. Most people handle their stress by isolating themselves, overeating, consuming large amounts of alcohol, smoking, spending hours on social media, or sitting for long periods binge-watching TV. And these health behaviors lead to heart disease, obesity, acquired diabetes, high cholesterol, cancer, and even dementia. According to the CDC, heart disease is the leading cause of death for men, women, and people of most racial and ethnic groups in the United States. About half of all Americans, 47%, have at least one of three key risk factors for heart disease, which are high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and smoking. One person dies every 33 seconds in the United States from cardiovascular disease. About 600,095 people in the United States died from heart disease in 2021 alone. That's one in five deaths caused by heart disease. Heart disease costs the United States about $239.9 billion each year from 2018 to 2019. This includes the cost of healthcare services, medicines, and lost productivity due to death. So at this point, you might be saying, okay, but knowing all of that doesn't change the circumstances of why people get depressed. No, it doesn't, for now. Clinical psychology, like medicine, traditionally focuses on finding the problem and then aims to alleviate symptoms. They do this, or we do this, with medication, talk therapy, diet changes, or regular activity. All of that stuff is great. And the fact is, 80% of depressed people do recover, but then relapse within the first year. What about the other 20% who recover from depression and don't relapse? What's their secret? CrossFit? Lots and lots of burpees and power-ups? Get you some! But no, it's not CrossFit. But CrossFit doesn't hurt. According to psychologist Dr. Tom Tomasulo, in his book Learned Hopefulness, depression's kryptonite is hope. Recent research aimed at improving symptoms of depression found it was a simple method of cultivating individuals' strengths by focusing on what was best in themselves that prevented participants from relapsing a year out. These participants also reported improved well-being and felt that they were thriving. Hope has also been shown to increase well-being by encouraging positive health behaviors like exercise, healthy eating, smoking cessation, and increased socialization. Hopeful people have a lower risk of acquiring heart disease, diabetes, dementia, cancer, and substance abuse disorders. So let us be clear about what hope is. The term hope has a long history. It's predominantly in Judeo-Christian discourse and named as one of the chief theological virtues throughout history. Hope is referred to positive expectations about matters that are reasonably likely to pass. We aren't talking about blind hope or false hope, nor am I referring to faith. Again, by definition, faith is expecting someone else to save you from a situation, whereas hope places the self squarely in the role of rescuer through action. So what does all of this mean? When we show people the good in themselves and give them the tools to express their goodness, they develop hope. Hope creates possibilities and changes in perspective that reactivate and reroute our mind circuits, allowing for changes in behaviors, perspective, and increased creativity. In this alternate perspective, we see future possibilities we can plan for and work towards, pulling us out of our apathy into self-efficacy and agency. We're no longer hopeless, but hopeful. Thomas Sowell says, "How well we envision what is yet to come will determine our motivation. We can override the default settings that tell us to shut down and protect ourselves when that setting is no longer serving us. And we can do this by shifting our perspective from what might harm us to focusing on what will save us, which is hope." Marty and Mayer aptly named this pathway in the brain the Hope Circuit and authored a book by the same name. Then in the 20th century, Dr. Seligman developed the scientific discipline of positive psychology to focus on the positive aspects of human life, such as happiness, resilience, optimism, and creativity. The idea that individuals and communities can thrive by cultivating their strengths and virtues rather than correcting their weaknesses and problems differentiates positive psychology from traditional practice. Its main aims are to promote positive emotions, engagement, relationships, meaning, and achievement, which Seligman later referred to as PERMA. The PERMA model allows individuals, practitioners, and researchers to assess, implement, and measure the outcomes of positive psychology interventions, leading to the improved well-being and flourishing of people and communities. Per the PERMA model, positive emotions are the pleasures and satisfactions that we experience in our daily lives, such as joy, gratitude, and love, where engagement is the state in which we are fully absorbed in our activities, using our character strengths and skills to pursue our goals. Relationships are our connections with others, which provide us with social support, intimacy, and belongingness. Meaning is the sense of purpose and significance that we derive from our experiences, our values, and goals, while achievement is the accomplishment of our goals, giving us confidence, mastery, and self-efficacy. This model and scientifically tested positive psychology interventions are used in various domains, including education, business, health, and sports. Scholars, practitioners, and researchers worldwide are using it to improve individual well-being, organizational effectiveness, and social welfare. For example, teachers use positive psychology interventions to enhance student engagement, motivation, and learning outcomes. Organizations use positive psychology principles in business to improve employee well-being, productivity, and innovation. In healthcare, practitioners use positive psychology interventions to help patients recover from illness, cope with stress, and improve their quality of life. Sports coaches use positive psychology techniques to enhance athletes' resilience, confidence, and performance. This interdisciplinary field draws on science from various disciplines, such as philosophy, sociology, neuroscience, and economics. Its diversity and openness make it a dynamic and innovative field with many opportunities for collaboration, creativity, and social impact. Compared to traditional psychology and its more intense long-term therapies, positive psychology interventions can be brief and involve simple exercises that can be practiced daily. So, for example, an intervention used to build empathy for elderly patients with hearing loss among medical students involves direct perspective taking. Medical students were instructed to insert earplugs in their ears and then to conduct and then undergo a medical examination. The intervention resulted in higher empathy scores upon completing a post-intervention survey, demonstrating that empathy can be learned and increased regarding other people's interactions of the world or interpretations of the world. One crucial aspect of positive psychology interventions is their ability to be judiciously applied. Take, for instance, someone seeking to build the courage to carry out an action or task. Sometimes it's more appropriate to help someone critically assess their goal rather than focus on building the courage to carry the goal out. A real life example of this was a client that had asked me to assist them in meeting their goal of orchestrating a smear campaign against a coworker they competed with for a big promotion. Rather than directly criticizing the goal, I asked the client to question the nobleness of the goal and calculate the emotional toll that it would take to carry out such an effort. People have to determine the merits of their own goals. As a positive psychology practitioner, I can only teach and encourage the principles that make up everyday ethics and values, and each person has the right to determine who they are within that system. In the words of George Bernard Shaw, life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. We are the result of our thoughts, actions, and environments. We can improve our life circumstances and the circumstances of others by developing simple habits that keep us present, engaged, empathetic, kind, and hopeful. One of my favorite quotes by philosopher William James is, "We must make automatic and habitual, as early as possible, as many useful actions as we can. The more of the details of our daily life we can hand over to the effortless custody of automation, the more our higher powers of mind will be set free for their own proper work." The sooner we start training our minds to look for goodness and kindness, the sooner we find it. The sooner we practice goodness and kindness, the easier displaying these virtues to others becomes. The sooner we get past petty squabbles, ego trips, and toxic consumerism, the more likely we will be able to recognize what really matters to us. Sustained happiness, engagement with the people and places we encounter, deeper relationships with the ones we love, finding meaning and purpose in everyday things while feeling accomplished and capable. In short, squeezing everything out of life we can get, because we only have about 4,000 Mondays to fit it all in. Well, we made it. The first episode is done and dusted. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for spending time with me today. Congratulations to you for wanting to be a champion for good. Remember to set your intention to perform one random act of kindness this week, small, medium, or large, does not matter the size, and leave a comment on positivelyridiculouspodcast.com describing how the act made you feel. Can't wait to read them. Before we go, guys, I want to give a quick shout out to my May, June birthday people. So I want to say happy birthday to Sherry Zhai from Shanghai, China, who's currently living it up in Philly, Pennsylvania. And also shalom to Naomi Fink, who is going to be moving to Israel soon. Love you, Naomi. Safe travels. And then also to a really good friend of mine, Jill Schulman in Santa Clemente, California. Jill, you're beautiful. Keep it up. And hola to Javi DiPino, who is in Madrid, Spain. Javi, happy birthday. Hope to see you soon. And then also the scoot to my scout, Kenaniah Henderson from Plattsburgh, New York. John Rosenberg, Toronto, Canada. Laura American in Denver, Colorado. Maritza Jackson, San Sandoval in Santa Cruz, California, Selma Sybil Fediak in Seattle, Washington, Tessa Virtue in Toronto, Ontario, Drew Dutton in Fort Worth, Texas. Happy birthday, guys. Last but not least, my cousins, Brock Brigai and Reagan Hogan, and to one of my two favorite nephews, Drake Bear. Happy birthday. Thank you all for all the goodness you bring into the world and the love that you bring into my life, because you make living positively ridiculous. Be sure to visit positivelyridiculouspodcast.com for episode resources and downloads. Don't forget to sign up for new episode notifications, shop our merch, and donate. You can also find us on Facebook. Just search Positively Ridiculous Talk. Thanks for stopping by. And remember, you belong here for good.